This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to this Joy 94.9 podcast.
We want to hear from you.
It's time for our listener survey. So head to the Joy website and let us know what you love about the station and your presenters.
Maybe you'd like to share your thoughts on Joy's program production team, the volunteers behind Joy Podcasts.
The results of this survey will assist us in continuing to be the best possible station we can be.
Head to joy.org.au and have your say. Joy 94.9, your voice, your radio station.
Good evening and welcome to The Informer. Dean Beck with you. Thank you very much for joining me tonight, where we will take a look at Australia's new shiny human rights commissioner. And if you're gay and Catholic, make sure you continue listening. I've got something for you. Well, last night we got to meet Australia's new human rights commissioner. He's only been in the role for some 5 weeks now, and his name is Ed Santow. He last night fronted Victoria's LGBTI community and delivered the keynote address following the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby's AGM. He began by comparing the Aboriginal struggle for land rights to the current struggle that our community is facing with marriage equality.
So back in 1982... Eddie Mabo started a legal process to assert control on behalf of himself and other members of the Meriam people over their ancestral land and fishing areas in and around the Murray Islands in Queensland and Torres Strait. Just 3 years after he started that process in 1985, the Bjelke-Petersen government introduced a bill, which was passed, with the aim of putting an end to the whole legal challenge. What it said was that when Queensland annexed the Maori Islands back in 1879, that freed those islands from all other rights, interests and claims whatsoever. In other words, if that had been successful, then with the stroke of the governor's fountain pen, it would have stopped in its tracks the Aboriginal land rights movement. And it nearly worked. But in 88, the High Court decided that the Queensland legislation was invalid because it was inconsistent with the Racial Discrimination Act. That case is known as Mabo No. 1, which is probably not the Mabo case that you're thinking of. The more famous Mabo case came a few years later. That was Mabo No. 2. And in that case, the High Court ruled on the more substantive issue, deciding that the notion that Australia was effectively uninhabited was a fiction that we could no longer entertain. Instead, the High Court introduced, as I'm sure you all know, the doctrine of native title. Eddie Mabo died less than 6 months before the High Court gave its momentous decision on native title. He'd strived for so long to right that injustice, and he won. But that win was too late for him to dig his toes into the sands of his ancestral islands in the knowledge that Australian law truly recognised it as Indigenous land. A quarter of a century after that legal victory, a kind of a counterfactual Australia, one where Eddie Mabo lost the case, where native title was rejected, where no land was returned to its Indigenous owners, it almost seems unthinkable. In other words, it's tempting to think of that history as inevitable. Now, what made me think about all that, what sent me down on all that rabbit warren was that I've been hearing the word inevitable a lot recently, and perhaps you've been hearing it too. Mm-hmm. I've heard that marriage equality is inevitable. And again, inevitably, as the broader community gains a better understanding of what it means to be bisexual, transgender, intersex and queer, our laws and behaviours will bend to accommodate their rights too. And maybe it's true. Maybe such changes are inevitable. But there are two big problems for anyone who yearns for a particular vision of the future that is said to be inevitable. The first is that inevitability is a label that can only be issued confidently after the event. Received wisdom has suggested many other inevitabilities that didn't come to pass, or at least haven't yet done so. When I was a kid, I remember hearing the TV show Neighbours couldn't possibly survive another season. It was just too bad. For decades, it's been inevitable that we would become a republic. I was in Canberra last week, and it was once inevitable that New Zealand would become an Australian state. The famous architect, Walter Burley Griffin, was so confident about this that he designed 8 avenues radiating from Capitol Hill. Each was given the name of an Australian state or territory capital city, including one avenue called Wellington. Wellington Avenue was hastily changed to Canberra Avenue when the inevitability of New Zealand's incorporation into Australia was replaced with the inevitability that it would not. In other words, inevitability is a label that bespeaks a confidence that is full of sound and fury, but can signify nothing or anything. Personalities, politics, events all change quickly, and one inevitability is replaced in an instant, like the magicians pull back and reveal, with another inevitability. The second problem with the inevitability worldview is it encourages fatalism. It implies that even by remaining passive, the inevitable day will come. It feels like a really dangerous game. The status quo tends to grip really tightly. Doing nothing generally produces nothing. Or it can produce something, it can produce change that is glacial, such that, like Eddie Mabo, you're not there to see the day when potential morphs, just as my patient science teacher promised me it would, into reality.
That's Australia's new Human Rights Commissioner, Ed Santo, reminding Australians and the LGBTI communities that the marriage equality cake is not cake until it had been cooked, and it's certainly not a wedding cake until it's been iced and decorated. Only then can we eat it too. So as we head towards this plebiscite, what role does the Human Rights Commission play? Our new commissioner last night explained.
At the commission, we endorse the widely accepted view that religious organisations that object to marriage equality on religious doctrinal grounds should not be required to, use the quaint word, solemnise a same-sex marriage. And that's reflected in the current definition, the current version of the Marriage Act. But that position, I acknowledge, is necessarily a compromise. As with any compromise, it involves some give from each side, but crucially, it aims to preserve the dignity of all parties to the maximum extent possible. So that's the Commission's position on marriage equality, and it's been our consistent view for many years. We're also conscious that we're in the middle of a vigorous public debate about this potential reform, and most acutely, how that reform should be formally considered. Whether that should be resolved by plebiscite is ultimately a decision for Parliament. But from a human rights perspective, we oppose plebiscites as a way of resolving issues of fundamental rights. At this stage, the terms of any enabling legislation have not been made public, and so we, like I'm sure everybody else in this room, are awaiting the release of a bill before commenting further. Broadly speaking, the Commission is particularly concerned to ensure there's an open, transparent and consultative drafting process. As the public debate intensifies, we see the Commission as having two key roles in relation to marriage equality. We first see an important, but perhaps not particularly prominent role for the Commission in promoting respectful discussions that accommodate the human rights and freedoms of all Australian people. That could mean discussing how to avoid, where possible, language that each side finds objectionable. Advocates of marriage equality have been telling me, among other things, that they don't wish to see the debate to be portrayed as something that it's not, such as a referendum on rainbow families having children or the Safe Schools program or something else. It's clearly about a change to the definition of marriage equality, of marriage, and nothing else. On the other hand, many opponents of marriage equality object to labels such as homophobe or bigot being deployed too readily. So there is, I think, a role for the Commission in trying to urge all of the advocates on both sides, on all sides, to be respectful of each other and to try and keep the debate within bounds that are not going to be any more harmful than is absolutely necessary. Secondly, the Commission has an important role in providing community education about the human rights issues associated with marriage equality. That can be done in a way that breaks down myths and promotes an accommodation of sometimes competing rights, beliefs and interests.
Ed Santow, Australia's new Human Rights Commissioner, speaking last night at VGLRL's AGM. Marriage equality, of course, is not the only human rights issue that directly affects LGBTI communities. Now, if you thought ex-gay ideology was simply the realm of the evangelicals or Pentecostals, think again. Over the last few years here on Joy 94.9, I've done quite a lot of work in the ex-gay space, talking about the ideology that either homosexuality can be cured or in some way you need to fix it. It came to my attention yesterday that the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne is sponsoring the Melbourne tour of Father Philip Bochansky. Now, he is the Associate Director of Courage International. It's a Catholic apostolate for people with same-sex attraction. Father Bochansky is coming to coach the priests here in Melbourne on how chastity is the way forward for homosexuals. This is an opportunity to hear from an internationally recognised leader in this area, their release to the priests says. Chastity.com is the retail portal, if you like, for Courage International. It's on that website that I found this YouTube clip. The program is called Catholic Answers, and the man with all the answers is Father Paul Cech.
There's a major distinction, Father Cech, that's often lost on people and not frequently enough, I think, preached from the pulpit. And that's the distinction between being and behavior, between the person made in God's image, worthy of the blood of Christ, and something he or she does. Maybe lay that out before you go to
Well, I think one distinction that the church preserves very carefully in this discussion, Patrick, is the distinction between person, inclination, and action. And we need this, otherwise we will perhaps fall into the trap that many believe the church condemns people who have a homosexual inclination.
You'll love this. Wait for it.
Nothing of the kind. The church uses the terminology objectively disordered to describe the inclination because it's inconsistent with the complementarity of the sexes and the procreative power.
Are you objectively disordered?
Of the sexual faculty. But that terminology, objectively disordered, which falls hard on ears, I grant, is not a moral judgment of a person.
Really? It's not a moral judgment?
It is descriptive of the appetite only. So,
The appetite for homosexuality.
Created in the image and likeness of God, redeemed by the precious blood of Christ, and inherently and intrinsically and always good. The inclination out of harmony with the understanding in nature of the two becoming one, man and woman, the one flesh unity.
Understanding of nature. Now, we have had that debate. We've seen many examples of nature having homosexual relationships. Did you know? Rams, only 50% of them are straight.
The action itself is grave matter, as are all violations of the Sixth Commandment.
Your homosexual act is a grave violation. Just reminding you.
Hence the adjective disordered attached to the inclination is because the object that is desired is itself intrinsically immoral.
The object, the other man, immoral.
It is not in keeping with the human good. That's correct.
Right. Okay, many ways to put that.
There are many ways to put that, all of them discriminatory. And Father Paul Cech, there speaking on Catholic Answers, gave us the answer. The act of homosexuality is a grave violation. And if you continue to indulge in that practice, you will never be seen as whole, complete, and welcomed in the eyes of the Catholic Church. The only way forward is to not indulge in the homosexual act. Ah, that's where chastity comes into place. The fact that Melbourne's Archdiocese could sponsor the tour of Father Philip Bochansky, Associate Director of Courage International, to come here and coach our priests on chastity as the way forward for homosexuality is immoral. How on earth any Catholic archdiocese in this country at present during a royal commission could cast moral judgment on our community is beyond comprehension. And I think if you're Catholic and you're listening to this, you should get in touch with your church and protest vehemently against the sponsorship of this man's tour. I asked our Human Rights Commissioner last night what he thought of this and what he would do to fix it.
In 6 days' time, Melbourne Catholic Archdiocese are going to sponsor the tour of Father Philip Boczanski, who is coming here as the Associate Director of Courage International. He has a website titled chastity.org. His cure for homosexuality is that we don't indulge in it, and he is here to train the Melbourne Archdiocese on how we, if we're Catholic, can find a way forward. When is the Human Rights Commission going to make a stand in this space and stand up for gay Catholics, let alone anyone else?
I hope this doesn't look like a dodge, but I'm going to take that question as a comment. I've never been able to say that before. I feel like I should give $5 or something to Q&A. What I'm doing as a big part of my role at the moment is taking in the advice from people who are directly affected by issues in relation to LGBTI, learning what's really important to this community. What I can say is that we'll do all we can in areas of responsibility to make a difference. What I can also say is we've got limited capacity. We're not going to be able to do everything. So I don't know whether we'll be able to do anything in that area, but I can promise that we'll take note of it as a very important issue.
Ed Santow, the new Human Rights Commissioner. Now, unlike the nation's previous Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, the newly appointed Ed Santow is not gay. And this is how he put that last night.
So if it wasn't abundantly obvious, I am a white, middle-class, cisgendered man who is married to a woman. And as such, I go through the world without the lived experience of a person from within the LGBTI community. I care deeply, personally and professionally, about these issues. But I am also aware that the absence of direct experience on my part means that I enter the space of LGBTI issues with much greater capacity to make mistakes. Please, please tell me when I do, especially if you have direct lived experience of the issues I'm given the privilege and responsibility to speak publicly about.
You don't, of course, have to be gay to represent the issues concerning our human rights. And I'll leave it to you to work out whether Ed Santow dodged my question earlier. However, Australia's Human Rights Commissioner has personally invited you, the community, especially those with lived experience, to step forward and inform him, guide him, brief him on the issues that directly affect you. It's now up to you to do so. Now, I caught up with the outgoing co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby after the event. Sean Mulcahy is the outgoing co-convener of the Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby. You've just had your AGM and you've had the new Human Rights Commissioner here. Congratulations. And I believe you are leaving the organisation. What's that about?
Yes, I am flying off to the UK on the 23rd of September to pursue my PhD, but I'm very excited. We've had such a fantastic attendance tonight. We've got fantastic new people on the committee and a lot of fantastic people, unfortunately, leaving us. But I think we're leaving the organisation in a position of strength. Rachel, my co-convener, is going to continue on and she's doing a wonderful job strengthening our organisation, and I'm looking forward to supporting the lobby from abroad.
Sean, in your time with the organisation, tell me what you think has been your biggest challenge.
I think there's always a challenge with leading LGBTI organisations because our community is incredibly diverse, has a diversity of opinions on every particular issue. And I think trying to reflect those opinions whilst charting a sensible, pragmatic way forward is always challenging for our organisation. I think one of the things I'm proudest of is the Royal Commission into Family Violence and their comprehensive recommendations on LGBTI family violence. And again, that's a tricky issue. We don't like to talk about it a lot, especially when our community's under increasing scrutiny from those that are opposed to rainbow families and our rights.
But it's also a subject matter that is intrinsically based on gender, and in our case, that's not the case.
And what we've been saying to the government and to the minister is we need to change that debate somewhat. Yes, the predominant amount of family violence is based on gender inequalities, but in our instance, there's a whole different power imbalance at play. And in particular, we need to acknowledge the effect of domestic violence on young LGBTI people, those kids that may not be loved because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, or intersex status. So we need to change the conversation somewhat.
That's a whole new level and a whole new dynamic that is about the child and the violence perpetrated towards the child. It's not about the parents and their power issues.
Well, let's not forget that there is LGBTI family violence with couples and parents. But yes, we do need to start acknowledging that there is family violence that is experienced by LGBTI children. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more LGBTI people in a situation where they're homeless. And there's very limited services available for LGBTI youth who are homeless, and we are disproportionately represented in homeless populations. So I think that's the next issue that the government really needs to be taking action on, ensuring that LGBTI people are safe.
And on that note, I raised the issue of people struggling with their faith and sexuality. It's an issue that is very much one of my hobby horses, but the human rights space doesn't seem to want to touch it because it's connected to religion. When are we going to see some action in this area?
Oh, no, we're more than ready to touch it. I mean, I'm an LGBTI person and I'm a Catholic. I don't think that there is an opposition between being a person of faith and being an LGBTI person. There are so many people within the faith-based community that are LGBTI or are LGBTI supporters. What we are seeing, however, is unfortunately a bit of an increase in the rhetoric around ex-gay therapy. And this is particularly concerning, and I know that the Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, Ro Allen, is taking a lot of work on board to address these particular issues. We know that this is fraudulent quack therapy that does not work. We've got a health complaints bill that's passed the Victorian Parliament that will allow people that have been victims of this therapy to report it and to allow the Health Complaints Commissioner to properly investigate it. And we should be taking action to eradicate this.
But it's greater than therapy. At its core, ex-gay ideology is the foundation of all homophobia in our Judeo-Christian society that we live in today. Until that changes, that cultural change, we will continue to have the discrimination that we as a community receive on a daily basis.
And that's why I think we need to build up these conversations between people of faith and LGBTI people. So just recently I was on Jewish radio speaking to Shimon Cowan, who is a rabbi who perpetuates the view that LGBTI people have something wrong with them and they should seek to have that illness, as he terms it, cured. That's just patently false. There is nothing wrong with being LGBTI, and there's nothing wrong with being an LGBTI person of faith. There are many fantastic people and organisations out there who are faith-based and LGBTI, and I think we need to start building those conversations, building it from the ground up, from the congregation level through the higher levels of religious orders, to ensure that we can create a culture where you can be both. You can practice your faith, you can be gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender and intersex, and there's no problem with that.
Sean, good luck with your studies. Congratulations on your time at VGLRL, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the continuing work that you and Joy do in bringing these issues to the fore.
You are with Dean Beck on The Informer. Now, there's been some changes to Victoria's adoption laws. Matthew Wade from Star Observer joins us to discuss this further. What's going on?
Well, Dean, essentially, late last year, they passed a bill that would mean same-sex parents could jointly adopt in Victoria. And as of, I think, last week, it's been enacted, couples can do that. It's legal.
That only kind of happens if it's through a foster arrangement or through a family loss, and therefore you're taking over, you know, another.
Yeah, exactly.
Am I right?
Yeah, there are processes online. There's information on the government's website as well if people are interested in doing that. However,
it's not perfect.
It's not perfect. People throw around the word adoption equality. I don't know if it's necessarily entirely equality yet because...
Well, equal is equal.
Equal is equal.
What you can do as a straight couple, we should be able to do, that's equal.
Well, exactly. No, yeah, you're right. But for couples that want to adopt a child via overseas surrogacy, the current law has no kind of legal protections for them, and there's nothing that ensures that they're going to be able to do so.
Because technically, in this state, overseas surrogacy is not legal.
Yes, exactly. Right. And so the day that the law was enacted last week, some people spoke out because they were unhappy with the fact that it wasn't entirely...
Well, what it does mean is that those who have had children through surrogacy overseas still technically can't... be the official parents in the eyes of the law locally.
Yeah, and they're left in legal limbo, I guess, so to speak.
Which has got to have some pretty horrific outcomes, you know, potentially.
Well, that's the thing. With adoption regardless, like, you know, it's so important for a child to have two legal parents, like, that can both be recognised on the certificate and things like that, because it's more than just a symbol. Like, it really means a lot to a child. So to have the act not entirely... promote equality or not be fully equal, I think, is a bit of a misstep.
Any word as to what we're going to do on that front?
Well, the government, I spoke to a couple of spokespeople, and they said that they were upfront about this from the beginning, and they knew that the law wouldn't, you know, necessarily protect people who wanted to do that or help them. They did say, however, that the only way they're going to be able to test whether or not it works for people trying to get a child via overseas surrogacy is by a family actually going through that process. So until a family...
It's challenged.
Yeah, until a family actually tests it out, we don't know.
So until a family has the money to challenge it in the court, see it all the way through to probably the High Court and be afforded to pay for that, we'll never know.
Yeah, exactly.
Matthew Wade from Star Observer, thank you so much for joining us on The Informer.
Thank you.
There'll be a podcast of the show available for download from Joy's website, joy.org.au/The Informer, a little later this evening. My name is Dean Beck. Thank you very much for joining me on the show tonight. Till next time, keep well, take care. Bye for now.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.